13 Questions by Man Transcending. Manhood in the Digital Age.
Okay, guys, welcome back to a special 13 Questions podcast. This week, we are not going to be doing the 13 Questions. We've got a couple of past guests, a couple of past favorite guests, a couple of my personal favorite people. We have David Fellman and Robert
Glover.
No more Mr. Nice Guy, Dating Essentials for Men. David, of course, has his new podcast. What's the podcast called, David?
The Impassioned Marriage.
Oh, nice.
Excellent. And I have, these are two of the smartest guys that I personally know, and these are two guys that have helped me along in my personal life by leaps and bounds. You know, I didn't really come around to starting to figure some of this stuff out until I was like 35. So I can sit here at 38, turning on 39, thinking that, you know, that these are definitely two people who have had a profound impact on my life. And I thank you both for it. So welcome to the show, guys. What we're going to do today is kind of just, I guess, sort of go through all the shit I've gone through in the last 3 years and sort of just put it out there more for all the other guys out there. Because what I found talking to David, reading Robert's books, is that, you know, it's almost like we're at this place in society where your culture is telling you a bunch of stuff that is not going to help you. It's teaching you to treat women, or it's teaching us, I guess, to act in a way that's not authentic and is not helping anyone. And I think I've been coming around lately to the thing that's from both sides. From the male side, we kind of get the no feelings and all that sort of side of things, the no more Mr. Nice Guy stuff, a seeking female approval. And then I'm starting to notice this other sort of thing on the female side, where they've got sort of some biology and some evolution and some subconscious stuff that at the same time our culture or society is feeding them a bunch of stuff that probably isn't going along with their biology in the greatest way either. And it's ending in, I mean, they say the divorce rate is 50% or whatever they say it is. But I think when you take the divorce rate and you add on ending just long-term relationships that maybe never do get married, and then you add on, you know, the classic loveless marriage that we all know somebody that's stuck in. And I mean, I think you're probably closer to 3 and 4 or maybe even approaching 80%.
Wow. I got no argument with those statistics, but I see a skewed population because by training, I'm a marriage and family therapist. And so that was my work for many years. I now mainly work with men, but the main thing I work with men around is their frustration in relationship. Yeah, that's kind of been my bread and butter, is seeing people that are unhappy in relationship. I'll just kind of put a premise out there that is kind of how I approach things. And that is, I don't think long-term monogamous relationships are wired into our DNA. Now, I'm in a monogamous relationship, but I found that when people kind of unconsciously approach, you know, this, oh, I found the person I love, we're going to love each other till the day we die. Number one, it's not organic. It's not what Mother Nature wired us to do. But number two, we go into it with all these unconscious needs we're trying to get somebody else to meet, especially somebody else of the opposite sex, and they're trying to get all their unconscious needs met. And because we're all so unconscious, they don't have a chance. I actually believe people can stay together for long periods of time. I mean, I'm looking at somebody right here who's been married for a long time, David. And it's not easy, but there are things we can do to increase our odds of really having a satisfying, gratifying, mutually beneficial long-term relationship. But I'll go back, for me, the key word is consciousness. We have to approach things in a very conscious way, and our society doesn't particularly teach us how to be conscious in much of anything, especially relationships.
Yeah, I would, Robert, I totally agree with you. I would add that in addition to consciousness, I think maturity is another top ingredient, mm-hmm, in this process, because I have yet to meet a 25-year-old that, no matter how conscious they are and aware they are, has the fortitude to survive, so to speak, the challenges of, you know, what it means. And you, as a marriage therapist, you've probably seen literally it all. You know, it's the whole process of a monogamous relationship is one of your own personal maturation journey, you know, and
I agree 100%. In fact, one of the things I've been saying, and I'm writing in the new book I'm working on, is that one thing really missing for us men culturally is that dynamic of maturity, and that we don't have masculine initiation, you know, that existed for centuries and centuries and centuries, thousands and thousands of years, masculine initiation. We don't have anything to teach young boys how to grow up and handle the challenging world of the masculine, which, relating to the feminine, is one of those challenges. So what I see for men a lot nowadays, especially the younger men that grew up with the internet especially, is they just hang out in the nursery. And the nursery is that place where everything's nice and easy and not challenging. You know, they surf the internet, they watch TV, they jack off to porn, they smoke pot, they eat junk food, they hang out with women and create no polarity with them. You know, they're being nice guys. And I agree that initiation that's necessary for at least masculine maturity is missing. And so that's why I'm writing the book I am, to teach men how to use our interactions with feminine creatures to be our masculine initiation, which increases the odds of those relationships actually being more satisfying.
100%. And to Darren's point originally, you know, regarding the messages, I find it, I can only imagine how, you know, I can tell how difficult it is for young men, because many of the, what I would call building blocks or stepping stones that men need to climb in order for them to reach a successful monogamous relationship, the messages in today's society tell them to step off the stones, not to climb up the stones. So when it gets hard, divorce is an option. When she's not satisfying your needs, you know, divorce is an option. That's just in one particular area, but even in other things, even interrelationship dynamics, you know, not teaching men the value of listening or communication skills, or, you know, just so many, what I would say, skewed messages that we get that don't encourage people or don't lead people. You know, your book is a perfect example. I mean, you came out with that book because young men were so off in the way they presented themselves, even, you know, not just a dating, you know, within the context of a monogamous marriage. You know, you see it all the time. So I would say, like what Darren was mentioning, you know, it's like a huge problem that we need to mature, and yet we don't know how to mature.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And you know, you come from a faith background that has, you know, initiation, that has rites of passage for adolescents, both the boys and the girls.
Oh yeah.
From at least in Western culture, that's mostly missing. And I'll just throw another piece in here to kind of, you know, monkey with where this conversation, you know, is going, is that, yeah, I just wrote a dating book. I call it the non-pickup guide to dating success. And I had learned how to date in my late 40s when I got divorced after 25 years of marriage. But I didn't, you know, I read The Game, you know, I watched DVDs, I, you know, got all the material, the guys kept giving me stuff. And I thought, you know, there's some valuable material in here, but it's not how I wanted to approach dating. I wanted to approach dating much more authentically, much more organically, much more respectfully. And I came across two articles in just the last few months in national media publications. The two of them really stood out in my mind. One is, it says, for the first time in like Western culture, let's say US, North America, for the first time, over half of all adults under 35 are single. And another article that said something like over half of all single men haven't had sex in over a year. Now, to me, those are two interesting statistics, because we live in what I call a hookup culture. You know, we've got online dating, we've got Tinder, we've got swipe left, swipe right, we got pickup, we got guys that are learning how to, you know, go get women. You know, we got women, you know, being encouraged to be more openly sexual. And while all this is happening, it's creating this kind of hookup mentality that is kind of like, all right, it's kind of like men and women meeting is pretty much just for the thrill of a few moments. And then because we've got, you know, our apps and online dating and pickup skills, we can't just settle down with one person and get to know them and, you know, develop something that is challenging and beneficial to both of us. Let's move on to the next. And ironically, is like everybody's skills and technology are getting better for meeting people and getting laid. Fewer people are in long-term relationships and fewer people are having sex. I'm thinking, what's wrong with that picture?
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's kind of crazy today. I was speaking to my niece and she had just come home from Oregon with a boyfriend of hers. And they are both just basically, I asked them both, I said, if you're standing in line at Starbucks and somebody came up to you and said, hey, how you doing? Can I buy you your coffee? You know, something that I would have done back when I was in my 20s, you know, no problem. You know, if I was attracted to the person and was feeling gutsy, that would have been a typical way to approach somebody, you know, whether it was at a bar, buy him a drink. And they both looked at me like I fell off, you know, the moon. I mean, the guy said, first thing the guy said is that if somebody came up to him and did that, he would for sure think that he's being punked or, you know, hoaxed on some level. And my niece said, you know, she would think it's nice, but she would definitely be very, very suspicious that something was up. Like, this is completely not normal. I mean, if you're not meeting, if you're not hooking up online with an app, essentially, unless you're, you know, you have to get by somebody and you have to say, excuse me for something, there's almost no excuse for, you know, just plain conversation. And I just found it so incredible.
And you know, that is like the number one skill I teach guys in my Dating Essentials programs. Just start conversations with people next to you on public transit, sitting next to you on an airplane. I teach men how, well, I call it testing for interest, where you pay attention and you gauge how high is their interest in having an interaction with you. And you know, a lot of people aren't interested in talking to a stranger. That's fine. But even just teaching men to say, hey, how's your day going so far? You know, or just making an offhanded comment, you know, hey, think it'll ever quit raining. It's like, that's pulling teeth to get a lot of guys just to make a social pleasantry. And I said, this is no agenda attached. You know, there's no attachment to an outcome. If nothing else, you're just making the world a better place because you ask somebody how their day's going so far.
Well, you didn't even attach gender to it. I think you said, look, if you're having trouble doing this with women, just do it with the guys. Do it with whoever you come across.
Yeah, I say do it with everybody. And then, of course, the men I work with take that literally. You mean every single person I meet, I have? No. Do it with everybody, meaning don't get so selective that you only do it with women that you consider to be a 10. You know, do it with everybody in terms of then if one of those people happens to be a woman that you find attractive, you're just going to do the same thing you've been doing with everybody, young people, old people, children. Even when I was single, I talked to men a lot more than I talked to women. Number one, I find men more interesting. And two, it actually makes you look more attractive to women if you're actually talking to men. Yeah. Then all of a sudden women go, who is that guy?
Well, I think authentically, I mean, most of the time, because I mean, that I'm pretty good at talking too much, but that's something I've taken on a little harder since reading the book. And it's kind of like, I mean, authentically, you're just, what I can boil like all those books down to is really a level of authenticity. because what I find is I'm never forcing myself to talk to somebody. It's more like I'm getting myself out of the fucking way so that I can talk to someone. I can pull that little bit of fear or whatever is, because in my head, I'd rather be talking to you know what I mean? It's not like I'm putting on an act when I'm trying to talk to people. I think humans are sort of wired to be intermingling and talking to each other all the time. And it's more of our culture that sort of pushed us into these little separate units.
Into our cell phones, basically. But even the fact that we want to spend a lot of time on cell phones, on social media apps, you know, points to the point you just made. We are wired to be social. We are wired to connect. And you know, not even more than 100 years ago, most of us never left our hometown. So we grew up knowing everybody. Now, most of us leave our hometown and we go places where we don't know everybody. And there's, you know, thousands to millions of people around us. And so because that tends to scare us, we all go into our apps and we create all these kind of artificial relationships. So, yeah, like I said, you know, I've been called a dating guru. The truth is I'm just trying to teach people some social skills, how to, as you say, get out of their own way and just walk through open doors of social opportunity, get to know new and interesting people. You know, I would say that the majority of women I dated when I was single, the woman I'm married to now, most of my male friends all have kind of organically originated by me just being a social person and having a conversation with somebody organically in a public place. That's how the majority of them have begun for me.
Yeah, well, that's one of the benefits of having a little gray in your beard. You know, you can pretty much say almost, you know, a lot more than a young guy just because it's taken differently. I remember just the other day I was driving through Starbucks at the pickup window, and this young woman who I had noticed there before was serving me, you know, my coffee through the window. And she has the most beautiful, like, yellow green eyes. I had almost never seen that color before. And I told her that. I said, "You have the most beautiful yellow, you know, yellowish green eyes." And she like stared at me. Like, I'm thinking to myself, okay, is this a Me Too moment? Or? But then she looked at me, she handed me my coffee, and she looked at me, she burst out into this grin, and she said, "Thank you. I really needed that today."
See, it's so interesting how that's it's changing. I think guys are subconsciously scared to flirt nowadays. And so the social interaction in person seems to be more difficult, yet the dating apps give people this like electronic consent to socially interact.
It almost, that's an interesting way to look at it. It is like a level of consent.
It's electronic consent. And that's why I teach people, you know, men especially, how to be the observer. Because, you know, not everybody's kind of just naturally gifted in terms of, you know, the ability to socially interact. And a lot of the men I work with have social anxieties, they're introverted, they're insecure. You know, they're afraid women are going to think. I tell guys, women know why we talk to them, by the way. If we start a conversation with women, they know why we're talking to them. We're hoping we get to see them naked at some point. Now, women know that going in, so now they've got to determine, you know, what is this guy's agenda? You know, blah, you know, what do I have to be careful about with this guy? And so, yeah, men do get really super conscious, self-conscious about that and kind of hesitant. And which just feeds into the, well, I'll just stay home and surf the internet rather than go out in public and talk to people. And really kind of just my most basic encouragement is, I've always said all my dating essentials are in podcasts. I say, get out of the house, expand your route, linger in public, talk to the people you meet, test for interest, and walk through the open doors. And, you know, I tell guys, miracles happen around people. And unless you got a living room full of people, you ain't going to have any miracles sitting at home watching TV, surfing the internet, playing World of Warcraft, whatever it is you're doing to avoid out being around people. And I'm like David. I mean, people used to refer to my Starbucks as being my office because especially when I was a single guy, even when I got into a relationship, you know, rather than sitting in my apartment on my computer writing, I always go to a Starbucks or a local coffee shop. I used to spend 3 or 4 hours every Sunday reading the Sunday New York Times, just being out in public. And again, it is amazing how many social connections I have just because of that process of getting out of my house and being around people. Well, that's where it starts.
Yeah, you know, doctor, I'd be interested in...
I love it when people call me doctor.
That's why you did it, right?
That's the only reason I got a PhD.
I was going to go for my PhD, and when the lady, when the woman who was taking the applications, you know, she was being all serious. She's like, "Well, why do you want to get your PhD?" And I just looked at her 100%. I said, "I've always wanted people to call me a doctor." That's yeah, pretty much it.
Why not? See, nobody ever asked me that, so I got under the radar with it.
Anyway, so I'm finding that this gap in communication and what Darren mentioned a little bit earlier, authenticity, I find that chases men into their marriage. And that ends up being one of the biggest stumbling blocks that men have to get their needs met in long-term relationships. Because, you know, they're dating, you know, let's just say they got through that phase, however it happened, but do men know how to authentically and vulnerably, yet masculinely, ask for their needs?
All right.
And go ahead.
Most of us don't. I'm going to give you a little mini seminar. This is one of my favorite subjects. So thank you for teeing it up.
Sure.
Here's the deal. I reference a lot our human ancestry. And for the majority of human existence, we lived in tribes. And again, David, you're from a background that had 12 of them.
That's
12
right,
tribes.
Exactly.
And you can trace back to who the father was of all 12 of those kids that started tribes.
That's right.
So we lived tribally and fairly communally, is what anthropologists tell us. Everybody shared everything. And relationships apparently were pretty communal as well. We did not start having pair-bonded relationships until less than 10,000 years ago, when we quit being hunters and gatherers and very nomadic and started settling down and owning stuff. And the term that most people use for that period of time is the patriarchy. I like to call it just the ownership model of things. Uh-huh. Where men started owning stuff. They owned their land, they owned a cow, they owned a goat, they owned a tree, they owned their wives, they owned their kids. And so we went private property. We went from this very communal shared experience, which is what is most deeply wired into our DNA, to now, you know, we went to, okay, extended family, but we've got now we're not even connected to extended family. So we've narrowed and narrowed and narrowed down our resources for getting our needs met in modern culture. But we still have that ownership mentality. When a man and woman meet each other and, you know, okay, we're in love. And I tell that the three requirements the average guy has for the woman he's going to marry is she's not too bad looking, which also means she's not too good looking because that's too scary. She at some point pays attention to him and at some point agrees to have sex with him. That's how most men choose their wives that they hope to be married to, you know, the rest of their lives. And what happens is we have this kind of going back to a word, Darren, you know, you and I were talking about just a little bit before I think you started recording, of fusion versus differentiation. Fusion is the model that says you belong to me, therefore you should. You know, you're my child, therefore you should. You know, you're a Glover, therefore you should. And we do this in our ownership relationships. You're my girlfriend, therefore you should. You're my boyfriend, therefore you should. And what happens as couples get more and more fused and connected and deeper into this ownership, you know, now you're my wife, you should want to have sex with me. You're my husband, you should want to listen to me talk about the bullshit of my head stuff that went on all day at work. You know, so we've got this ownership, you should. But what happens is when we're depending on one person primarily, or maybe one or two or three, we're not going to get our buckets filled. We're not going to get our needs met. And I teach people, and this is kind of a core thing I teach in a lot of my workshops, is to create something consciously that I call cooperative reciprocal relationships. I know there's a bunch of big words, but it's real simple. I have people draw a stick figure of themselves, and then around them draw a bunch of circles around them with arrows going from them to those circles pointed in both directions. And what a cooperative reciprocal relationship is a relationship we have with another person, an organization, a professional, in which everybody involved is getting some needs met. That we right here have a cooperative reciprocal relationship. You know, Darren and Graham, they've got some guests on their show, and they get to have something to talk about and put up on the internet. You've also got listeners. Your listeners get something out of it. You get something out of presenting it. David and I are going to get something out of being on this show together. He and I will get something out of it because we're going to get to know each other better. There's everybody's getting something out of it. It's cooperative. It's reciprocal. Now, unfortunately, most adults do not have many of these in their lives. And so I have people make a kind of a mind map, you know, to make all these circles. And first of all, I have them, you know, write down all the cooperative reciprocal relationships they already have. It might be, you know, a best friend or two or three, might be family, might be church, might be a dentist, it might be a doctor, it might be a personal trainer. So I have people, first of all, get a look at what they do have. Then I say, let's now create another mind map, but we need to start with a bunch of empty circles, and we're going to start putting in there what we need. A financial advisor, an accountant, an attorney, a chiropractor, more best friends. I do this periodically myself. And right now, I've got probably 10 to 20 really good quality friends that I didn't have 2 years ago because I put on my mind map of this cooperative reciprocal relationships, I need more masculine friends. I need more men friends. And I also put down that I needed some sort of coach or therapist. And once I opened myself up to that, a guy that came to one of my workshops told me about a coach he worked with and a men's program he leads. And I contacted him, hired him as a coach, and then the next year joined the men's program, which I'm in my second year. And now I've got all these circles with all these really great men and a coach. And, you know, we go on 3 retreats a year. And it just expanded my life because I identified I needed these things. Same thing. In the last year and a half, I've added a new accountant, a financial advisor. I've added people in systems to help me get my needs met. Now, the third part of the assignment I have people do is to write down and go back to the list of cooperative reciprocal relationships they already have and make a list of which of those they need to renegotiate or maybe even pare back. Because a lot of us have some of these, I did that with my accountant. I wasn't loving the, you know, what I was getting from my accountant. And over time, I kept trying to negotiate it to where what I wanted more. It didn't work. So I pared that back and went and got a different accountant. I've done that in friendships where I realized, you know, this guy was a good friend for me at one time in my life, but for whatever reason, it's just not working. Maybe we've been tried to make it workable and renegotiate until I finally reached the point of realizing I wasn't getting anything out of it anymore. So it was time to actually say, I'm going to stop being in contact with you. Not because I was mad, not because I was hurt, I was getting nothing out of it. And the attempts to try to renegotiate and get more out of it weren't going anywhere. So this, I believe, now that we're not tribal anymore, we create our own tribe. And that is we identify what is it we need to fill our bucket up, to be a full person, to take the pressure off our one best friend or off our partner, and especially off our children, because those aren't actually cooperative reciprocal relationships unless the children are adults and they're voluntarily having a relationship with us. If they're little kids, it's not the same thing. So I found that when people do this, especially when I teach men to do this, it makes them a hell of a lot more attractive to women if they're single, and it makes their relationship much more robust with their wife because they're not expecting their woman to meet all of their needs, which she can't. And it lowers all that resentment that tends to build up between couples over time. It's like, again, well, you're my husband. You should be doing this. You're not. So I hate you. Or you're my wife. You should be doing this, you know, but you're not. So I resent the hell out of you and I'm going to go look at porn. If we're taking full responsibility for all of our needs, and that's my definition of a mature adult, it shifts everything.
I would even Go ahead, David.
Pretty intense. Those are some awesome techniques and, you know, exercises that you have your clients, you know, working through. That's good for you. That's really fantastic. And it certainly would contribute to creating a more wholesome and well-rounded, you know, person, and therefore a more wholesome and well-rounded relationship. Darren, I'm going to let you go. I'm going to give you the floor in just 1 second. I wanted to ask, though, I'm going to ask a tough question, Doctor. Okay.
You mean these haven't all been tough questions?
So you had mentioned, you know, taking responsibility for getting your needs met. But as a marriage therapist myself, you know, and I'm sure you've experienced something similar, you know, where the rubber hits the road is when there are needs that can't be met except for through your partner.
Okay.
And those seem to be the, you know, the sticking points, you know, at least in many of the situations that I'm working in. I don't get that many men that my sage advice is, you know, join a bowling league. You know, I mean, although I can imagine that being the case, but I get a lot of men where they just are stuck not being able to get from their wives what they can't get other places.
Okay. So what we're talking about is in our quote, monogamous exclusive relationship, we only fuck each other, right?
That's definitely a way to say it. I wouldn't have used those words, but yes.
Well, yeah, I used to be religious and then, you know, I never swore until I was in my 30s. So I'm making up for lost time.
Go for it.
So I hear what you're saying. Yeah, exactly. And I was in a fairly sexless marriage for about 14 years. When I married my second wife, she announced on our honeymoon, "Aren't you glad that now that we're married, we don't have to pretend to like sex anymore?" Wait a minute. Did I misunderstand something here? And, I was a true blue nice guy. And I thought, oh, I can get us through this. Even though I knew that had happened in her previous marriage. She had told me that when she got married, she lost interest in having sex with her husband. Well, that won't happen to me. It did. And so, you know, I spent 14 years, you know, and trying to figure out how to get this woman to want to have sex with me. And so I've been through that pain. I know what that pain is about. And I don't have like, well, here's the easy answer. I've got some things that might help. And part of that, again, is in the book I'm working on right now, is that I actually think that sexuality can be vibrant and exciting throughout the lifetime of a relationship. I believe that can happen. I believe women are actually wired for that, even though it's the women that usually tend to get the blame for the lowered sexual interest. A lot of things can contribute to this. It can be, you know, abuse issues from childhood. It can be trust issues. It can be abandonment. Men do all kinds of things to mess with a woman's sense of trust in long-term relationship. Every time we tell our partner we're going to do something and then we don't do it, it messes with her sense of trust. Every time we're keeping stuff in and not telling her what's in our head, it messes with her sense of trust because she's got to imagine the worst possible thing. You know, maybe you're driving down the road and she's sitting next to you in the car and, you know, you're trying not to fart because you just don't want to, you know, to offend her. And she knows you're holding something back. She doesn't know what. So she's going to assume that you're still thinking about the woman's tits on that corner back there. So she's assuming you're fantasizing about that woman that she saw back there. And you're just trying not to fart. That's what happens. That stuff goes on. You know that. The assumptions people make based on our stories. And men lie to their partners a lot. You know, if a man thinks, well, if I tell her this, she's going to be upset, or we're going to have an argument about it, or I'm going to have to defend it. So guys just don't tell the whole truth. And a lot of times they just flat out lie to their women. All of that kills a woman's vulnerability, her willing to open up and be penetrated, basically. And a lot of men have they're terrible at asking for what they want, which you've already mentioned, and they have terrible sex skills. I say that unfortunately, most men learn how to do sex by watching porn and learn how to apply cologne by watching Axe body spray commercials. You know, they're both very unrealistic. So that is often what is those, all those dynamics are going on. Now, with all that said, I think when people do have those cooperative reciprocal relationships in every area of their lives, they're more full and therefore more attractive, and therefore already have the skill set for getting their needs met and are more likely to be able to do that with their partner sexually. I think if people are willing to dive into why do we have this problem? Is it because one has abuse issues and they're guarding themselves? Is it because the guy's told so many lies or half-truths to his woman, she doesn't trust him anymore? Is it because the guy's shitty in bed? You know, there can be a lot of things. Now, but when that's all said, the conclusion I came to in my marriage is that monogamy implies availability. So it'd be like for a person in a relationship to say, you know, because you're my partner, you can only have sex with me, but I'm not going to have sex with you. It'd be really no different than saying, you know, you're my partner, you can only talk to me, but I'm not going to talk to you. It's that kind of logic, if you actually break it down, is not logical. It doesn't make sense.
And it's horrible. It's abusive.
It can be. And I know when, after about, you know, towards the end of my second marriage, my wife and I had been in tons of marital therapy. All the things she said, well, if you just change this, then I want to have sex with you. That never happened. And I remember telling her in front of our therapist, I said, I am going to have sex. My preference is that it be with you. But just because you don't want to have sex doesn't mean I shouldn't. And I told her that. And both her and the therapist kind of nodded. There is a woman therapist. How do you argue with that logic? Just because she doesn't want to have sex doesn't mean I shouldn't. And I was giving her the invitation for her to be the one that I have sex with. And if she refuses that invitation, why should I not have sex just because she's refused the invitation? And I'd done my work. I mean, I'd worked on being honest, you know, having integrity about showing up in the relationship, and it still didn't change the system. And what I soon found, another term I use, especially in dating, I call it being willing to get to rejection quickly. And once I made that announcement and it became really, really clear, she had no interest in our relationship being any different than it had been throughout the marriage. We, not too long after that, quit being married.
How many years, this is your second marriage, how long did that last?
That was 14 years.
Your first marriage was how long?
About 10 years.
Okay, which one was the 14 year was the sexless marriage?
The basically sexless marriage, yeah. We go 6 months or more without sex.
Right.
That was standard operating.
Uh-huh. Wow. That's a long time. And for many years, that must have been really tough.
And that's for sure. I when I got out and learned how to date,
you made up for it.
Well, I did okay. And I quickly realized I did not like casual sex. I much preferred to have sex with somebody I felt a connection with. And then I've now been married close to 3 years to my present wife. And she'd be happy to have sex two or three times a day. And if we go more than 2 days without sex, she assumes I'm having an affair with somebody else. Because what other reason could there be that we haven't had sex in 2 days?
Finally, it took you 25 years, but you got what you wanted.
And you know, and now that I'm in my 60s, it's kind of like, oh, not again. You want to have sex again? Give me a break. We had sex this morning.
Yeah, God's sense of humor, you know.
I do love God's sense of humor in that way.
Why couldn't it have been this when you were 22? You know, you have to wait till you're 60 years old.
Exactly. Oh, wow. But, you know, I'm smiling. Life's good. You know, I'm grateful for everything that's come my way. I'm grateful for my past relationships. And both of my ex-wives know I'm grateful for them. And I'm glad my life has taken the path it's taken. We're sitting here today having a great conversation. And we're both helping making the world a better place for everything we've been through.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting in our religion. I'll just add this little piece. I think it's kind of fascinating, and most people I tell find it pretty fascinating. So in our religion, there's a law, basically, that as long as the woman experiences a menstrual cycle, so these laws wouldn't wouldn't occur after she goes through menopause. The men and women can't be together at all physically for essentially the week of her cycle and then another 7 days after that. And when I say that you can't be together, I mean you can't touch each other. You can't even hand anything to each other. So if she said pass the salt, I would have to pick up the salt, put it down next to her, and then she would have to pick it up and take it. That's how
literally the term is she's unclean.
spiritually unclean, not physically unclean. Yeah. It just creates the most, it's a very difficult dynamic to get used to, but it's also a very, talk about polarity. Mm-hmm. Because by the time you haven't been together with her for 2 weeks, I mean, you're just like a volcano ready to erupt and you just cannot keep your eyes and hands off of her. And then she goes to what's called a mikveh, which is this ritual bath where she immerses herself and she prepares herself essentially for intimacy with her husband. And a few things that I think is really a good takeaway just for everybody, because not everybody's going to do this, obviously. It's only, you know, the most observant of the Orthodox Jewish people that do this, or in general, the Orthodox people do this. But that separation and that tension that grows really changes the whole dynamic within a relationship. And just one more thing about it is that, and I'd like to hear, Doctor, your opinion on this as well. It forces a schedule. So for instance, for her to, for you and her to not be together that first night after she's clean, you know, spiritually, would be like taking a sledgehammer to the relationship. I mean, there would have to be some serious, serious issue going on between you where she wouldn't do, you know, she wouldn't be available. So it kind of, not only does it create this tension where you're completely separated for 2 weeks, but it kind of forces you together. It doesn't matter if you guys got into a fight that afternoon. It doesn't matter if some bill hasn't been paid. It doesn't matter if she's upset at you about something. That night is your night together and you never miss it. So like
I love it actually. I've got Jewish acquaintances who've told me, you know, and I have a background in religion, so you know I've studied these things as well. But same thing, my acquaintances said that they really like it. They like that time, the break. The men and the women both like that time away. And you know, I mentioned the book I'm writing. The tentative title, the working title, is called Positive Emotional Tension. You must have said, you know, tension, emotional tension, 2 or 3 times. And it is at the core of the polarity that I'm teaching men and women of how to keep that relationship, you know, exciting and alive and vibrant. Uh-huh. And the basic premise of that book that I'm working on is that women have to experience emotional tension with a man to be attracted to him, sexually aroused by him, and to stay attached to him over time. Uh-huh. Now, unfortunately, we men tend to hate emotional tension, especially in relationships. We want everything calm. We want everything smooth. We want everything secure. And so we either never create emotional tension for the woman, and this is part of the long-term problems with men sexually in relationship, or a problem with them getting laid at all, is they do nothing to create emotional tension for a woman. They're passive. They're indirect. They're pleasing. They're nice. None of which creates tension for women. You know, men go, why do they always go for the jerk, you know, for the asshole? Because he creates tension for them. It's that simple. And for we men in long-term relationship, when our woman is creating tension, David Data says that for women, drama is foreplay. So while they're creating foreplay, we're trying to, you know, we're putting the wet stuff on the red stuff. We're trying to get that thing put out and get it back to calm, back to good, so she'll want to have sex later on. Uh-huh. Right? And so we wonder why we have problems in long-term relationships. So the core premise of what I've been teaching men and of this book is that it is in that healthy space. It is in the gaps that beauty and tension and polarity exist in art, in music, in dance. It's the space between, it's the gaps, it's the time apart when I was learning to salsa dance, and you're learning to, you know, lead a woman on a crossbody lead, and you know, salsa has this 3 out of 4 beats, and the fourth beat is a pause. And women want to rush right through on that fourth beat. And I'd have to tell them, say, no, pause, pause, let's pause on that fourth beat. You get to move your hips and your body. It's what makes salsa sexy. It's the pause, not the 1, 2, 3. It's that pause. Uh-huh. And so I work with men and, you know, when I get a chance with women as well, teaching them, you know, consciously create that space between, create the healthy distance. You know, my wife and I live here in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. I got two stepkids. Her kids are 12 and 14. And we've got a very healthy relationship. Like I said, she loves to have sex. That's not a problem. And I have an office door with the doors closed, you know, so I come in my office. When the doors are closed, she will not walk in my office. She'll stand out. She won't even knock on the door. She'll stand outside and wait for me to see her. I'll say, you can come in. She goes, no, if your door's closed, I'm not going to come in until you ask me to come in. She respects that space. Wow. Right?
Well, yeah, and people think that's a bad thing, but it's not a bad thing. I mean, these people that it's, you know, I was listening to a story the other day about when a couple gets so close that they don't even close the door when they go to the bathroom anymore.
Yeah.
And it's you think that's the perfect relationship when in actuality, it's probably doomed to fail because there's no space and there's no polarity.
There's no differentiation. There's no space. There's no time away. And I travel a lot. And my wife knows at times I book trips to go for work or visit family in the States. I take her with me frequently, but she knows when I don't. When I just say, I've got this trip booked, she knows it's because I just need some alone time. And she'll even say that from time to time. I know you need your alone time. And I do. We men need more of that than what we realize. And she respects that. And I know when I was married, even in my second marriage to the woman who didn't want to have sex with me, during that time when I quit being such a nice guy, I started taking road trips with guy friends to go watch baseball games in ballparks around the country. So I'd be hanging out with 3 to 5 guys. And we've been to your city, David, to watch baseball, you know, went to Fenway, not Fenway, but Wrigley.
Wrigley.
Went to Fenway too. And after I'd done three of those trips, I remember her telling me I'd come back and she'd say, you know, I just got to tell you, I'm so much more attracted to you when you've been away with your buddies. And when you come back thinking, all right, this is a woman that never wants to have sex with me. She's telling me she finds me attractive. So that healthy space is just so crucial. And I believe that men have to consciously create that. You know, in my dating books, I'll say, don't be texting the woman all the time. Stay off the phone with her. You know, let both of you have the anticipation of, hey, we're not going to see each other, you know, for 5 more days till we have this date set up 5 days from now. Let some tension build up. The date will be a lot more interesting if you haven't already dissipated all the energy by talking on the phone for 3 hours every night before you see each other. Yeah. So create healthy space. And that's where the beauty is. That's where the sexiness is. That's where the polarity is. That's where the tension is. The coming together, moving apart, coming together, moving apart. That is what builds tension just so fundamentally for men and women.
Well, ultimately, yeah, that's kind of where those relationships all live anyway. I mean, we did some shows on Grimerica with Heidi Sheffer, where she was talking about, I mean, when you really boil it down, none of your relationships are within either person. So it's like the world is built up on all these one-on-one relationships is one way of looking at the world. And all of those relationships actually, you know, exist in some space between us. So yeah, if you're all crammed in together and enmeshed with no boundaries or anything else, I mean, that space is going to become a polluted mess.
Well, David, you may be familiar with Esther Perel. She wrote Mating in Captivity.
Yes, of course.
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. I remember listening to her as an audio version of that book, and I'm thinking, this is the book I wish I had written. I mean, I highly recommend it. Two books that I highly recommend to couples. One is Passionate Marriage by Dr. David Snarch.
Snarch, yeah.
Snarch is great. He's brilliant. Esther Perel is brilliant. But her premise is that actually what she would define as intimacy actually works against polarity and sexual tension in relationship. Basically, the more we're just, you know, open and open book with each other and just totally known by the other, even though those are good things and good qualities, it actually has the tendency to kill the sex drive. And so, you know, there has to be a consciousness in there of how do we have intimacy, i.e. being known by an intimate partner, a long-term partner, with at the same time having some mystery, having some apartness. You know, if you both know what each other did all day long, what the hell are you going to talk about later on? You know, there has to be some of that apartness to bring some mystery back into the relationship. When I come back after being away from home for 10 days, there's things she, you know, we're going to catch up on for the next 10 days of what she did while I was gone, what I did while I was gone. And we, and my wife and I actually do not talk a lot with each other when I do go away. We'll text each other. We'll let each know how we are, what we're up to. But we might talk once, you know, over a video while I'm away for 10 days to 2 weeks.
Wow.
And it just builds.
Yeah. You know, and I kind of think this kind of goes back to something that we were talking about originally, which is, in my opinion, what I would call, you know, a relationship maturity. And I feel that when a man differentiates, and that's David Sonar, Snarch's yeah. term.
Yeah. Snarch talks a lot about differentiation. He actually stole it from Murray Bowen. He actually stole it very well. He presented it well, but Murray, you know, for the geeks out there, Murray Bowen.
Yeah, Bowen was right. That's right. So what happens is that, and this is something that I would like to work with men on, is that when there's a natural shift in our understanding of our role as a man in relationship from one of receiver to one of giver, then in a automatic way, the neediness dissipates. It's mm-hmm. just a consequence of that. When the neediness dissipates and when your spouse realizes that you're not coming into this relationship to necessarily it's not that you don't need your spouse, but you're not coming in from a place of neediness. In my opinion and in my experience, that itself builds that tension. Because when she looks at you and realizes that she's looking at a human being, a man, a leader, who doesn't need her, but just wants her, it's a whole different dynamic that you've just set up in that relationship.
I agree with you, David. I think you're right on with that. And it's, you know, we were chatting a little bit about Mark Manson before we started, and about, you know, his book Models about, you know, dating, and how it's really not about dating. It's about, you know, how to be a mature man. And we're talking about how he begins his book on dating about don't be needy. And you're right. Neediness is just, it's a buzzkill for women. And when you approach a woman, whether it's a woman you just met, or the woman you've been married to for 15 years, if you're needy, and here's going back to the sexual thing that you're asking about earlier, one of the things I've seen so often with men and women is that when men are not filling their own bucket, I'll just kind of keep it simple, when we don't have our cooperative reciprocal relationships that fill us up as we're giving and getting, we go to our woman needy. And often we go to our woman with our sexual neediness. And women are sensitive to this. It's like, you know, this, like when Ross Perot was running for president many years ago, you know, he talked about that big sucking sound that the federal government makes, you know, and that's what women experience a needy man as. There's this hose coming towards them, and all they can hear is that big old sucking sound, and women will put their guard up to that. Now, what happens is because we've layered our sexual wants and desires on top of our core neediness of not feeling filled inside, we bring that to our woman, and all she sees is neediness. Oh no, he's going to hook up the hose to me and suck the living daylights out of me. And so they put a wall up. They protect themselves from that hose, the neediness. And what we guys think is she just rejected me sexually. Uh-huh. She wasn't. She wasn't rejecting the sexual want. She was rejecting the emotional neediness underneath it. So I agree with you. The more that men can do to create that sense of, you know, fullness on their own and not to want their woman and not need her. The coach I work with, John Wineland, who's worked with David Data for many years, he repeats the same thing. And the kind of the metaphor I use for men is you got to create your great cake of a life. And I kind of spell out the key ingredients for me, at least, have been pursuing my passions as a key ingredient of that great cake. Having good guy friends, another good key ingredient. Regular strenuous exercise. We got to be kicking our own ass to feel good about ourselves. Leaning into challenge and some sort of spiritual practice, whether that's, you know, faith, whether that's personal development, and then giving our gift to the world. So that is what I think helps make men feel complete. That's our great cake. And I tell guys, we can have a cake without icing. Women are the icing on a great cake. Whenever we try to make a woman the cake of our life or even a key ingredient of that cake is going to go flat. It's not going to turn out well. And we're going to get dependent and needy. But for example, I know one reason my wife is so amazingly attracted to me is my life is full. I'm living my passions. I'm writing books. I love my work. I love the difference I'm making in the world. I have my guy friends. I've got a gym in my house. You know, I work out. She's a gym rat herself. I have good guy friends. I'm leaning into challenge. I'm in my 60s. I'm still leaning into challenge in every area of life. And she knows I don't need her. She knows I love her.
Right.
She knows I want her, but she knows I don't need her. Yeah. And that's scary for a lot of women.
That's the polarity right there. Cause you know, and I was just thinking that, you know, and one of the things that I also work with men on is that this entire process occurs. This is just completely my take. So I understand that people see things differently, of course. This whole process occurs over the lifespan of a long-term monogamous relationship, meaning this is the building blocks, the stepping stones. I used that before. This is the pathway. This is the journey that being in a locked-in, no-exit relationship causes for men to experience, you know, when they realize and they wake up and they say, hey, wait a second, this person is not going to satisfy all my needs. I need to, and it starts with the core need of intimacy. I need to create my own life. And I believe that that's, you know, I'm not trying to psychoanalyze you by any means, but I'm convinced that your journey through your relationships and the suffering that you had gone through, specifically through your second marriage, was the impetus for your success with your book and your ability to even see. Without that relationship, you know, you'd be a marriage counselor. You know what I mean? You wouldn't be no more Mr. Nice Guy.
you've nailed it. And that's why I say I'm grateful for both of my ex-wives, that second wife that, you know, I can tell, you know, what sound like horror stories about it, but she was actually a very brilliant, intuitive woman, ass shit crazy in a lot of ways, and a really big stick upside my head that wouldn't let me just get away with sneaking by with being a nice guy.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful for that big stick. And I tell guys, everything I read, everything I write, everything I teach, my podcast, my classes, my seminars are all the stuff I've struggled with in life. No More Mr. Nice Guy is not a chronicle of my successes. It really is a record of all my mistakes, everything I did that didn't work. And
I love that line in the book where you say, you know, as a therapist, I can so relate to what you said. You were describing the scene where man after man was coming in and out of your office, and you're like, and they're telling you all their woes, and you're like, wow, you sound, as the therapist, you're saying to yourself, wow, you sound exactly like me.
Yeah, I've said all those exact same things that you're saying. And that's when I thought, wait a minute, there's something going on here I need to take a deeper look at. I'm not the only guy thinking, I'm such a nice guy. I treat her well. I'm different than her ex. I'm raising her kids. You know, I'll do anything for her. How come she's never happy? How come, you know, it's never good enough? When's it going to be my turn? How come she never wants to have sex anymore? I thought when other guys were all saying the same thing, I thought, I need to pay attention to this.
And so, you're the therapist, right?
Go ahead.
So, David, you mentioned that, you know, the guys that you see that can't get what they need from the people that they're with. Would the stuff that you guys are talking about now, like being authentic, listening, not being needy, you know, being being that guy, is that gonna improve that situation in a large percentage of them, or is it beyond that?
Well, I always tell all my clients that if I had a magic wand that could get their wife to do whatever they wanted, I'd be richer than Jeff Bezos and more popular than Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So I wish I had that ability.
Yeah. Strange bedfellows there.
The only thing that I can do working with men, and the recommendation that I always have is, and this is a common phrase online, is to be the best version of yourself. So what that's going to mean and what that's going to look like is for a man to start feeling comfortable with what he needs. First of all, he needs to define what he needs. Many men have no idea what it is they actually need. What are their values in a relationship? You know, what do they stand for? The person needs to define those things. And once they define them and they can stand in strength in those values, which doesn't happen in one session, it doesn't happen in one day. Once you understand that, then you have to learn how to communicate that, you know. And like Dr. Glover was saying just a minute ago, like he had at some point he realized that, you know, intimacy within the confines of a marriage is not a luxury; it's a requirement. It's mandatory. And his wife wasn't on board with that message, but he eventually had the strength to stand up and say, this is my need, and this is what I expect. And he made himself vulnerable in the sense that he said, I'd really like that to be with you, you know. And and again, this is also from The Passionate Marriage. It's one of his techniques. He talks about how when you're able to convey to your spouse in a vulnerable, strong, clear, and confident manner what your needs are, that's the top of your game. And it says a lot about your relationship if your partner is willing to forego. You know, he says there in that book that most partners won't forego it. They may forego it originally. They may say, okay, I hear you. But it's only a matter of time in a loving, good-willed relationship where the partner will, you know, it's only a matter of time where they're going to acquiesce if what you're asking for is fairly reasonable. That's his take. And that's been my experience as well. So that's what I like to work with guys on and men. And it's a whole journey, you know, because many men are afraid to ask for what they want, or they don't even know what they want, or they're ashamed, or it's a whole, you know, I don't know. Doctor, what do you think?
I'm sitting here nodding my head for those who can't see. And Snarch says in the Passion of Marriage book that we both referenced that he says everybody can do exactly what they want, but there are consequences for doing what they want. And the woman, for example, if we're talking about a woman in this case, can say, no, I don't want to have sex with you. And that's fine. And there's always a consequence to everything. And for a partner to think, well, I should be able to do what I want and not have a consequence to it, that's not how the world works. And that's not how relationships work. And so there is a consequence. And I agree that it kind of goes back to, you know, when I talk about creating that diagram of our cooperative reciprocal relationships. Doing that diagram, I found, really helps men a lot, especially because we're so visual. Because I know and I think I say this in No More Mr. Nice Guy, so many times when I would talk to men about making their needs a priority, you know, they kind of get that deer in the headlight look, like, oh no, I'll be in trouble if I make my needs a priority. Because that's our paradigm from childhood often. And I would hand them a legal pad and say, okay, let's start, you know, just writing some things you can do to start making your needs a priority. And I've had guys just sit and stare at the pad and just say, I have no clue what my needs even are. Right. And so that's sad if you think about it, that a man could get to being an adult and you know, they do know what their needs are, but they've also been conditioned to perceive of themselves as needless and wantless, mainly out of fear that if they do have a need, there's going to be ramifications or consequences. So this is a part of our masculine initiation, is not only learning that we have needs, that's a good thing, and as adults, we are responsible for getting our needs met, but how do we go about doing that? And so that's why I like doing that, the diagram around the cooperative reciprocal relationships. And as we've kind of both alluded to and stated, when a man is good at getting his needs met, number one, he's less needy, so therefore more attractive, again, whether he's single or in a relationship, and he's going to be more skilled in the process of getting his needs met, and therefore more likely to get his sexual needs met as well, just because he has more skills and in his ability to get his needs met. So there's a lot of payoff all the way around for men learning how to skillfully get their needs met and to take full accountability and responsibility for that. Yeah. As an adult, I don't get to blame anybody on this planet if my needs aren't getting met. That's solely on me. That's my job. I'm accountable for that. And if I'm blaming somebody for my needs not getting met, that's me being a helpless, childlike victim. And again, that ain't going to make me very attractive, and it's not going to make me at all happy either. So right. It works a lot better if I take ownership of it.
Yeah. And the converse, you know, the opposite of that in some ways is, like, I think we're talking a lot about getting your needs met, but I also work with men on, I wouldn't use the word the opposite of that, but boundaries. And that's another way of getting your needs met, meaning establishing behavior that's not acceptable within the confines of a relationship. That's really tough. Because, you know, it's just as challenging as it is for me to say, hey, I want you to do X, Y, and Z. Sometimes it's even more challenging to say, hey, can you please stop doing A, B, and C?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's another area where it's really tough. You know, and many men, I think, are sideswiped. You know, I work with men who complain to me that their wives humiliate them in public, or, you know, or do other things to them that are, you know, maybe they yell at them, or they criticize them, or they, you know, they threaten them. And it's really hard. It's hard to work with people. You know, it's a journey, basically, for a man to get up and say, hey, you know, this behavior is unacceptable, and I won't tolerate this in our marriage. And yes, we're still going to stay together, but you have to stop. you have to stop doing this. It's tough.
Better to do that sooner than later.
Yeah. Oh, I agree so much with that, Darren. I'll tell you two quick stories about boundaries. And believe me, I agree with you 100% about their need. Boundaries are what allow people to get close to us. If we don't have boundaries, we're either going to isolate or put up walls. Boundaries, we get to decide who comes in our space, what they get to do, how long they get to stay, when it's time for them to leave. Again, boundaries are another adult behavior, just like getting your needs met. The two quick stories. One is when I started my own journey of recovery back in my second marriage. I went to a therapist, and in the very first therapy session, she put a string down on the ground and did a little demonstration with me about boundaries, you know, her side of the string, my side. And it was very like, wow, this is profound. I was in my 30s on my second marriage. I had a PhD in marriage and family therapy. I had never heard of boundaries in my entire life. Now, I don't know if this therapist just knew that most people needed training in boundaries, or she could just look at me and say, this is where we start with this guy. First session, we talk about boundaries. But those were transformational, because I was trained, as all children are trained to put up with bad behavior. Why? Because the big people get to do whatever they want, and the little people have to take it. That's just how the world works. So we grow up to be big people, and we don't realize, oh, we don't have to take it. We can say no. We can say stop. And the second story is in the men's program that I'm in. Last year, we did a process called a feminine reconciliation, where we have to go back and take all the significant women in our life and really kind of do a deep dive into those relationships. you know, with ex-girlfriends, partners, mother, daughters, whatever, and look at where we failed to show up in masculine leadership, where we failed to appreciate the gifts that that person gave us or embrace their love. We just have to kind of do that evaluation of it. Now, I don't know if this was kind of the intention of the exercise, but here's what came clear to me looking at, you know, two past marriages, some other relationships, that in every single case, the problems in that relationship were 100% on me. And here's why. And this goes back to something Darren said just a minute ago. In every one of those relationships, I could pinpoint the first time the woman acted badly. And for each woman, it was a different bad behavior. For some woman, it might be just like disappearing, ghosting, and not showing up or calling back. For another woman, it might be, you know, out of the blue saying she's going to break up with me on a Friday, and then on Saturday she wants to get back together. For another, it might be being overly controlling. For another, it might be being verbally abusive. But in every single situation, I could pinpoint the first time the woman acted badly, acted inappropriately within a long-term relationship, usually within the first few weeks. And I realized what was on me, that in if each one of those cases, if I'd been a differentiated, conscious, boundaried man, I would have said something pretty simple. And it would have gone basically like this. If you want to hang out with me, you don't get to do that. If you want to hang out with me, you can't do that again. If you want to hang out with me, you have to do it this way. Now you decide. I guess it's a snarch. You can do what you want, but like Snarch says, there's a consequence.
Yeah.
But what I always did is I'd like put up with it or try to talk them through or get them over it or get them down from
fix
it.
Fix it.
Fix it, make it better. And in every single case, and I have done that in other cases where I set boundaries really early on and watch the woman fall more in love with me, as I basically said, if you want to hang out with me, you don't get to do that. You're going to have to do it like this if you want to keep hanging out with me. And it wasn't controlling behavior. You know, it was stuff like you can't keep going back and having sex with your ex, those kind of boundaries. Yeah. Or, you know, you can't just get
mad. How you're willing to be treated, basically.
Yeah, how I'm willing
to be telling them what to do, but how you're willing to be treated.
And whenever I did that, the women responded well. It activated something. And so I said, this is like one woman when I said, all right, you can't keep sleeping with your ex if you want to keep hanging out with me. So you decide what you want. You know, you decide. She came back like a few days later and said, I told my girlfriends that you had said that. And all of my girlfriends said, that's a good man. You need to quit sleeping with your ex and get all in with that guy.
That's right.
And she said, I'm not going to see him ever again.
Yeah,
and
that's so, a leader. That's what it means to lead in a relationship.
And it did. And she felt safe and felt aroused and felt attracted. But my point was with boundaries is that we men as adults cannot complain about anybody that's treating us badly if we've tolerated it, trained them it's okay, put up with it, tried to convince them to quit doing it, but did not draw a hard line. Mm-hmm. That's on us. And that was a powerful takeaway for me to realize that the more time I spent with people who didn't treat me well, reduced the amount of time that the door might be open for somebody to come in who would treat me well.
That's a great point. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, that makes, I mean, this will be the final thought since we are about out of time here, but I would take that boundaries thing one step further and say that most men are probably, I would say maybe not even just men, but this is a man show, so we'll say most men are probably, like 75-80% of the times you're pissed off at someone in your day-to-day life, take a look at yourself and ask if have you actually expressed anything, right? Whether it's someone cutting on you in line or whether it's, you know, I'm sick of this fucking guy. Every time he comes in here in the morning, he's slurping his coffee, but you've never mentioned it one fucking time. So it's hey, like,
Graham, is that you?
You know, it's take a look. Take a look within.
He's never said anything. So
and if you've never opened up your mouth, then you might as well just turn around that anger back at yourself because you've been too much of a pussy to say how you feel or how you think or, you know, you're willing to put up with.
For so many men, and this is true for me and it's true for a lot of guys I've worked with, you know, we have such a fear of conflict. And our fear is if we draw a line and set a boundary with somebody, say, if you want to hang out with me, you can't do that. We're afraid that, you know, they're going to have a big negative reaction to it. in my experience, a lot of times they have a very good reaction because they didn't realize they were slurping their coffee and getting on our nerves.
Yeah, yeah.
And nobody ever told them, right? Yeah. if we could do that with love, we actually invite them into higher consciousness. I tell the guys I work with, are the best boundaries are the ones that invite the other person into a higher consciousness. Nice. So, but if we don't tell them, they're not going to know. And I tell people, if you set boundaries with people and they become hostile, you just got to rejection quickly.
That's
don't
a pretty
hang
good
out
sign,
with
yeah.
hostile people. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I call them professional boundary invaders. And often these are usually family members and or the person we're in a relationship with. And if they react with hostility to loving, clear boundaries, that's something we need to pay attention to.
Yeah. Well said.
Well said. A good a spot as any to wrap it up. We've gone through 90 minutes just like that. Robert predicted it before we started.
I called it. Hey, I called 2 hours.
That's right. So, I mean, hey, maybe we can do this again a few months down the road and maybe we can find something else to focus in on. But it's been fantastic to talk to you guys again. I owe you both a debt of gratitude. So thanks again for coming on the show, and thanks for all the help in my
great.
Personal life.
You're welcome. Yeah. It was fun. David, good to meet you. Good to
nice
talk
to you. Meet
you next
too.
Time, let's try not to argue with each other so much. You can agree on something.
This
next
is a
time.
Problem. You guys need better boundaries.
Yeah. We do, actually.
Thanks, guys.
All right, guys.
All right, have a
come back
night.
Anytime. Have a good night.
Why is one man rich and another man poor? Why we ain't satisfied? Why we gotta have more? Why your suicide rates on the rest so high? Why I tell you the truth but you say don't lie? Why is being a good father at an all-time low? Why is it acceptable? Yo, why? I don't know. Why she blame him and he blame her? It's useless. Ask yourself this question. Why you making excuses? Why do parents gotta bury their kids? Why we text and drive, not caring how scary it is? Why it's so hard to forgive and leave the past behind? And if you did, then that's divine. Why don't you help your brother when you see him fall? Why do we act like God don't see it all? Why do we call them black, them white, them Asians and use labels? Now that's racism.
I don't want no hoodie.
Why?
I don't want no hoodie. Yo, why? I don't want no hoodie.
Why?
I don't want no hoodie. Yo, why? I don't want no hoodie.
Why?
I don't want no hoodie. Yo, why? I don't want no hoodie.
Why?
I don't want no hoodie. Yo,
why is there innocent people locked up for life while some people can't say nothing nice? Why do we always gotta question what all of it means? And why won't you follow your dreams? Tell me why. The night when you took my dad, why'd you let me see my grandpa cry? And tell me why. And why do you choose to hide, even though you was born to fly? And tell me why. And why don't we turn from all the hate? And why don't we learn from all mistakes? Why do I keep on wrecking these fat beats? And teachers don't make more than professional athletes. And why?
I don't want no hoodie.